Hello, thank you for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links that you may find interesting at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, there's a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that offer, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address www.hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. If you make a purchase through that deal, it's cheaper than Amazon, and it's also a good way to support this podcast. Books on the list are written by authors who have featured on this podcast previously at some point. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, and Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter. And there's also sociologist Olivier Roy's new book, Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit the page for the offer, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. You can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But that's enough business. Let's get on with this latest episode, in which Ryan Gingeras makes a return for his record third appearance. Ryan is a historian at the Naval Postgraduate School in the US, and he previously wrote a very good and accessible biography of Atatürk, which we spoke about on this podcast, as well as a terrific account of the final years of the Ottoman Empire. Check out the Turkey Book Talk archives for both of those conversations. But in this episode, we talk about his report, penned for the Bipartisan Policy Center in the US, entitled Deep State of Crisis, Reassessing Risks to the Turkish State. The country has obviously been rocked by a series of terror attacks, particularly last year, and the failed coup attempt of July 2016 has had a huge ripple effect, with well over 100,000 people being fired or suspended, and state institutions going under huge strain and undergoing a huge reshaping. The report gives a brief overview of the fearsome security challenges facing today's Turkey. It was actually published back in March, but I started by asking Ryan to talk about what the motivation was behind writing the report in the first place.
I think in terms of motivation, Nicholas Danforth brought this idea to me if I'd be interested in writing a report. And it was actually predicated by something a little different, which was, one, there had been these articles written in sort of the last 6 to 12 months, I'm thinking of two specifically by Michael Rubin, where, you know, people had talked about, you know, these threats from inside the Turkish government being the greatest threats to Turkish stability, and sort of the dredging up again of the existence of something like a deep state in Turkey, and that this deep state was, you know, eventually going to come after Erdogan or come after the state. And the notion was to sort of do a piece that has essentially two components to it. One, try to sort of contextualize and explain why and how people think about, you know, conspiracies or sort of deep state type politics as so critical to, you know, how people think about stability in the country and the development of the country. And then the second, to sort of tease out what kind of threats are there in Turkey to its stability, and evaluate them side by side, somewhat critically, both in terms of external threats and ones from within. And the core conclusions of the piece, sort of twofold. One, that there's a longstanding problem in Turkey in that people see threats emanating from within Turkey as a critical element in the making of the country. In other words, there's this lingering kind of schizophrenic suspicion and apprehension that the greatest threat to the country are actually internal ones, specifically ones that kind of emanate from within the state itself, as well as from within society itself. And then the second component being that if we are to evaluate Turkey's stability and the various factors that could lead it to becoming more unstable, we have to seriously take into consideration that certain pillars that people see as at the foundation of Turkish governance today are actually, it's, you know, may actually hide some of the greatest threats to its long-term stability. And that is sort of the integrity of the AKP, the potential sort of politicization of the military into new factions, and also the proliferation of paramilitary forces as either organized by elements of the Turkish government and bureaucracy, as well as the sort of security apparatus, but also within the party itself. And, you know, where I sort of fall on is that, well, you know, we sort of can contemplate the kind of threats that groups like the PKK or, say, Islamic State pose towards Turkey. But, you know, we have to really consider the fact that we have components within the state itself that are actually, they're not hiding in the shadows. It's really quite in the open, that are rather worrisome, and that could really have a really dire impact on the country's future.
Yeah, I suppose in the last few months, of course, since the coup attempt last summer, there have been all kinds of reports of different factions kind of arming themselves. I saw a report, I think, last week that was saying that licenses for private citizens owning arms had really shot up in the, to coin a phrase actually, had really gone up in the months since the coup. I mean, what would you link that, like, directly to the reaction against the coup attempt, or?
I think it's, well, undoubtedly, I mean, you can't divorce the coup attempt from a phenomenon like this, but I think that that actually is, that is not as conclusive as other evidence that's out there. Expansion of the village guard system, I think, is really quite worrisome, especially for the fact that it wasn't that long ago that there was at least some lip service to the idea of eliminating it as an institution for provincial security in Eastern Anatolia.
Just to clarify, like, they've expanded it into urban areas.
That was my next point, is that these sort of the creation, this announcement, I think it was last week or the week before, of creating a new neighborhood guard system is terribly worrying, because it's not clear. There's so much, you know, that's uncertain about such a thing, you know, training, something like a command of controlled structure, what kind of laws would govern their use, what sort of authorities they would have. It's very troubling. And then I think, you know, you add yet more sort of fuel to this this phenomenon when you consider that there have had these reports about the AKP actually organizing something like an emergency sort of militia system in the case of another coup. And there was this video that got circulated, I think it was on Cumhuriyet first, in which there was a recording of this meeting in which the speaker, who was associated with the party, made some sort of reference to the fact that, yes, you know, if something happens, there'll be sirens, we'll have cars. And then he seems to say we'll have weapons, but there's a cough. There's like a noticeable cough the moment he says weapons. So which, you know, was sort of initially kind of, you know, wheeled out, you know, in Cumhuriyet saying that, yes, you know, they were talking about making these roving armed militias, and then a retraction saying, well, we don't really know what he said. He could have said sirens, or he could have said whistles or something. I don't remember what it was. But in any case, I mean, this is yet another sort of worrying sign that, you know, that a practice that was seemingly going in a direction towards, you know, creating a more stable and professional internal security, you know, service, one that would be highly professionalized and bear no resemblance to sort of past, you know, the past use of, you know, of private militias, it now seems to be not just coming back, but coming back very quickly with a really fierce vengeance. And then, I mean, sort of lastly, I think it's worth noting that, you know, there are still these kind of lingering reports about these militias, these mysterious militias in Eastern Anatolia, the Esudullah team, pictures of which, you know, these this graffiti in Shirnak and other places, with, you know, from supposedly this group blazing yet another specter, that there is yet another kind of parallel paramilitary system that is organized by God knows who. So all in all, it's these are worrying signs, although it's not clear what it's actually leading to.
Just quickly on that point, like after the referendum result was announced, like a couple of weeks later, the JAP got kind of mocked, because one of their speakers was saying, oh, well, we didn't come out on to protest against the results because we were afraid that, you know, we've got evidence that the AKP cadres have armed themselves and it could lead to kind of civil war if we hit the streets.
Yeah.
And it kind of got mocked because it was said to be a kind of them using it as an excuse to basically do nothing as they have done in the aftermath of the referendum. But there's probably kind of a seed of truth in there. You know, there is a real danger that with the kind of devotion and the building up of these very kind of shady groups linked to the AKP, there is a kind of danger that they could, you know, take matters into their own hands, I suppose.
I mean, but, you know, truthfully, I mean, that's, there are two aspects to that. Like, one is, yes, you know, is this a sign of the Jehipit's basic weakness? Yes, it is. I think there's lots of evidence to suggest that institutionally the Jehipit doesn't know what to do in the aftermath of the results. And, you know, undoubtedly there are lots of excuses they can fall back on. This could be one of them. You know, as a general rule, I mean, I try to guard against being too Chicken Little about Turkey's future. I think rather than start with the principle that civil war is possible, because I think there is this sort of millenarian kind of aspect within Turkish society, in Turkish politics to begin with, in which it's either absolute stability or civil war. That's the choice. I think it's a false choice. And my fear is that it's a self-fulfilling possibility, given sort of how heated the politics is. I mean, I would put it this way, you know, that society has grown so tense and the politics has grown so polarized, and that there are lots of small tinderboxes that are kind of, that, you know, one can find in various corners of the country, you know, or different phenomena that could set off violence. I mean, I think it's more the question of there's real possibility for some kind of violence, but also violence not necessarily of an intercommunal kind, but also sort of a state reactive, you know, kind of violence, which we've sort of seen in the last year or 2 years. So I'm not really sure, you know, I think it's a fear that's warranted, but I wouldn't be so quick to sort of say, you know, what it actually would amount, you know, what these fears actually amount to, or what is sort of the, what, how things are going. I'm not sure, and I'm sort of afraid to sort of venture a guess.
Just kind of zooming out a bit, I guess when you were writing the report, it would have been the kind of beginning of this year. The report was published in March.
Right.
And that would have been the time just after the ISIS attack on the Reina nightclub in Istanbul on New Year's Eve. And that really was a kind of nadir, I think, in terms of Turkey's security, because it had followed a really horrific series of terror attacks from different groups in, you know, all parts of the country in the months running up to that. And of course, with the coup in July last year, things were looking very bad indeed for a while. And it looked like Turkey was kind of trapped in this spiral of violence and instability. It's kind of, I don't want to tempt fate, but actually since that Reina attack, there's not been any major terror attack in that's caused mass casualties in Turkey, which is, of course, a huge relief. And actually a bit of a surprise looking at the prognosis just shortly after that attack. It looked very, very dark indeed.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly did. I mean, certainly it kind of was in the background of, writing the piece. And when I was, you know, sort of trying to put it together, I wanted to not really kind of be in the moment and talk about necessarily trajectories, you know, that, you know, either there's going to be more terror attacks or less, or that, you know, intercommunal violence was going to tick up or tick down, or there's going to be greater state, you know, crackdowns or not, to try to lay out all the various factors that could sort of push Turkey in one way or another. You know, I do devote some time to, you know, the threat of, you know, extremism, especially Islamic extremism. And I think that it's, you're right. I mean, I wouldn't want to tempt fate either by saying things are going better or going worse. I think I'm no longer in the business of trying to predict sort of the trend, you know, or sort of the continuation of certain trends in the country, especially given what happened last July. So, I mean, I think it's a good sign, but I think that if there's one general sort of tendency that one should look at, is that there are a wide variety of sources that could contribute to growing radicalization and militant behavior in the country, be it from people who were veterans of, you know, of the Islamic State, you know, people who are inspired by, you know, the PKK's campaign campaign last year, kind of, you know, some sort of new wave of Kurdish terrorism. One could even sort of think about some kind of revival of a, you know, a radical left movement in Turkey on a much wider scale than we see now. So, I mean, I don't want to sort of evaluate, it's really difficult to evaluate Turkey's internal security, you know, services or its intelligence services, because it's so much of what's reported is done through innuendo or through these sort of insider accounts, which may or may not be totally fictitious or, you know, mistaken. So I think it's just, I think at this point, as far as we know, it's a blessing.
I heard a great conspiracy theory about this, actually. They basically said this kind of wave of terrorism was encouraged by the Obama administration and the American deep state. And as soon as Donald Trump came to power, it all came to a halt.
I think it exemplifies sort of the how supple, you know, the kind of culture of conspiratorial thinking is in Turkey, is that there's such a long standing narrative of outside intervention and meddling in Turkish, you know, domestic politics. You can kind of come up with, you know, theories or sort of a new kind of plot turn based on, you know, the past, but because there is so much sort of past material to work with, both that is kind of based in reality and partially and totally based in fantasy. So the sort of thinking, you know, conspiratorial thinking in Turkey really doesn't know any bounds. I mean, there's sort of no actor that cannot be included as a part of the cast of the deep state.
I suppose one of the dangers is that when this kind of stuff takes on a momentum of its own, and if the decision makers in the state are basing, you know, strategic decisions on what they perceive as great conspiracies that are under the surface, that's like a huge threat to security itself, because, you know, the diverting energy and resources and attention in directions where it shouldn't really be going.
Well, I mean, that's the problem. I think that, you know, and this is the real change that has occurred in the last 5 to 10 years, is that there was a real hope that there was going to be a much more institutionalized or more systematic pattern of policy making and decision making within the country, and that there would be greater sort of authority and influence on the part of Turkey's various bureaucratic organs in the formulation of policy. And in the end, we've gotten sort of the opposite, that the circle of policymakers has grown really small, to the point that we don't really know, you know, the sort of the full extent to which, you know, anybody has any influence over policy outside of Erdogan himself. And when you consider that that circle is so small, it's so hard to know how their world view really shapes the way they make policy. All you'd know is that if the circle was much wider, and that if there was something like, sort of, you know, the sort of term gets used here, something like an interagency process where different aspects of the bureaucracy or the military, you know, have opinions and have, you know, certain priorities and play different roles in the making of policy. Things like conspiratorial thinking kind of comes out a little bit in the wash when you consider sort of the interests and attitudes of, you know, not just individuals, but institutions as a whole. So you're right, it's really hard to know. And that's the thing that I think is sort of the mantra. It's worrying.
You talk in the report about how Erdogan is always looking for allies in the state, or he has done up till now, and basically turning to different groups to achieve his objectives. Before, of course, the classic case is the Gulenists, who were very close allies and are now, you know, the arch nemesis. Since the coup attempt, the stock of the ultra-nationalists or Ülkücüs has risen. And there's also, of course, the kind of Eurasianists who are affiliated with the Vatan party of Doğu Perinçek, who are thought to be gaining influence. But there's also, kind of underlying all this, also the sense that the government and Erdogan are trying to develop kind of state cadres that are just purely loyal to Erdogan himself.
Right.
And this is seen as the kind of remedy to the kind of chronic instability that leads to coup attempts and other threats to national security. So Erdogan himself is kind of seen as the backstop, and he's just the person as an individual who can guarantee the security of the state, and that's where loyalty should be declared, not to some kind of more abstract idea of the state. You know, it's this kind of idea of the reis, the chief, rather than the state itself. You know, he is the state and he embodies
it.
Could you just kind of talk a bit about all this jostling, you know, these groups and this other dynamic that kind of supersedes all that stuff, where it's basically just, you know, you're having to declare loyalty to one man?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I mean, the problem is that we kind of devolve into this kind of parlor game of trying to guess, you know, where the winds are blowing politically, and, you know, how long anybody can last within, you know, as a favored group or ally of the president and, you know, his inner circle, let alone who is actually in the inner circle itself. And, you know, this kind of, you know, Kremlinology, you know, from an academic standpoint, I think is all sort of what we have left. We don't really know. Again, I think that one thing is very clear, you know, while it may be the case that you have the staffing of certain positions, be it in the military or the intelligence service or maybe, you know, different elements of the bureaucracy with people who come from different strains of the Turkish right. One thing that is totally clear, and I think without a shadow of a doubt, is that these aspects of the Turkish right, you know, be it their ideas, but also their motifs, that a lot of people thought were really kind of out the door. They were kind of a fragment of a bygone era of, you know, the 70s and 80s and 90s, and, you know, really kind of were contrary to the sort of new ethos that, you know, the AKP had cultivated, that was sort of light, you know, sort of Islamically tinged, but, you know, seemingly kind of seeking a new inclusivity within Turkish society. We've had this kind of radical backturn to this kind of nationalist rhetoric and iconography, which is, you know, based in a really exclusive reading of what it means to be Turkish, and a really kind of, frankly, xenophobic reading of the world at large, which is sort of remarkable unto itself. And I think is more, I don't know if it's necessarily how much it reflects what Erdogan believes, or, you know, his sort of thinking about, you know, how to build coalitions in the country. What it certainly suggests, though, is that these sorts of qualities or these sorts of strains of Turkish nationalism have never really gone away, and are still very potent in mobilizing at least some people, maybe not the majority of Turks, perhaps, but they're still very potent. And the fact that they are allowed such room to sort of express themselves, you know, be it, you mentioned Perinçek as one example. Another would be somebody I've written about quite a bit and sort of really interested in, is somebody like Sedat Peker, is that, you know, here's a guy who, you know, I mean,
he's a former mafia kind of crime lord, really. He's very disturbing.
I mean, but what he is, I mean, but what he is now is sort of, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't know if he's necessarily, you know, involved in organized crime anymore. It's sort of complicated, but he represented a political subculture that was really influential and destabilizing in the 80s and 90s. And there was all sorts of signs, not less than 10 years ago, that not only was he on his way out, but that he would receive some sort of punishment as a result of, you know, sort of his past activities and because of his, you know, his worldview. And now he sort of enjoys a great deal of attention and seemingly a good amount of legitimacy, you know, within the media, or at least that, you know, the people are willing to sort of let him have his his space and the ability to sort of to talk, in which, you know, as you know, not everybody is afforded that kind of privilege on Turkish television or in the press. So I think that that's telling of something. I'm not really quite sure of what it means institutionally, but clearly, to get back to your original point, the bottom line is, you know, Erdogan and the AKP have trouble playing team sports. I mean, they have real trouble with working cooperatively, making compromises, you know, with political factions. And there's this sort of revolving door of different personalities and groups and parties that have kind of come in and out of favor, with no sign that this is ever going to really end. I don't know where that leads. I'm pretty certain, though, as again the conclusion sort of is clear in the report, that this doesn't help stability. This actually hurts it, and that's something that people should, you know, take note of.
Yeah, that leads on nicely to the next question, actually, because it does raise this question of state capacity. It's something we've talked about on this podcast before, but there's really, since the coup, there's been this kind of whole generation of qualified civil servants that have basically been shunted aside. You know, obviously some of them have been involved in plotting, but at the same time, you've kind of, they've thrown the baby out with the bathwater in a lot of cases, and expertise and institutional knowledge has been lost. And there's been a lot of reports about all kinds of unqualified people getting appointed just based purely on loyalty to the AKP. And it's not just in the security services, it's also in the, of course, in the judiciary and other state institutions. Could you just talk
education,
a bit about that?
Yeah. Education, health. I mean, from all standpoints, I mean, since the state commands such immense portions of services in the economy, it's, you know, I think it radiates into so many different aspects of people's lives, and it's hard to know. I would emphasize, and I didn't, this is not a point I make in the report, but it's something that I think people have to also consider, is that there were really great strides made in the last 10, 20 years within within various elements of the state in terms of professionalization, increased increased budgets, sort of growing internationalization of standards and cooperation across the board. And it wasn't that long ago where people were really quite excited at the possibility that, you know, the Turkish government was, you know, behaving in a way and beginning to develop in a way that was more in tune with civil society, and that was sort of anxious to develop a reputation of being, you know, competent and transparent. And that momentum is gone. I mean, I think that I don't know how that comes back after all of this. The other thing I think to consider is that even with some of the strides of the last 10, 20 years, we also still have to consider that there were really serious weaknesses that were evident in different elements of the state. Now, I mean, I've sort of looked at it and sort of familiar, you know, with this sort of issue, you know, from passing standpoint. I mean, it's not, there, you know, some ways I've sort of kind of learn about this or sort of seen it through either through studying or, you know, through my studies or through my work in the U.S. government. But, you know, it's clear that, you know, for example, if you look at the judicial system and if you look at, you know, issues like policing, there were really major strides. I mean, to the point that, you know, the Turkish, you know, there were aspects of the Turkish National Police that were really, you know, a regional, in some respects, a global leader in terms of investigative approaches, in terms of professionalization and so on. But there are also really clear weaknesses that derive from the nature of the judicial system and the legal code. You know, for example, you see this especially in the case of, you know, with the Ergenekon trials, that there's still a kind of lack of due process when it comes to things like processing evidence, you know, how witnesses can be evaluated within a court of law in a way that preserves something like an impartial analysis of a case. I mean, to this day, you can still, the state still uses secret witnesses to prosecute cases, and a lot of what is put forward as being matters of official record come from sources that, you know, are pretty dubious, which has an effect on how things like, you know, policing is done. If you can, you know, if it's easy to manufacture evidence in this way and not really be able to parse it for impartiality or even for it being false. So all that said and done, now we're in a situation where the integrity of these, you know, of various bureaus of the Turkish bureaucracy has been wiped out by the purges, you know, with hundreds, if not thousands of people discharged from state service. Whether they're being replaced or not is not clear. Who's replacing them is not clear. One can only imagine that things like loyalty and subservience are qualities that are being looked at more seriously than things like competence or impartiality, let alone sort of loyalty to something other than just Erdogan. And so I think, no, I mean, it's not good. And I don't think we'll really ever know the extent to which the damage has been done until, you know, we're sort of several more years out from this moment.
And just to conclude, I mean, I think following on from that, there's also an element really of self-fulfilling prophecy, it seems to me, as well. You know, such has been the level of mismanagement, and, you know, rule in all areas has become so personalised that it has really become a situation where, as the government has been saying for years, really, basically, after Erdogan, it really may well be a very serious instability because everything has become so channeled through he himself.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I think, you know, sort of circle back to what one of the sort of original intentions of the report was, is to sort of look at, you know, this question of stability or instability through, you know, a much broader lens, you know, sort of a broader historical lens. And it's clear that, you know, if you look at what how Erdogan talks about politics, but also sort of surrogates within the press talk about politics, one even could even say, you know, even opponents sort of mimicking this as well, is that people are thinking about Turkey in an elliptical kind of way, that, you know, the problems of the past have not only not gone away, but they're now, there's this sort of revenge, you know, there's this, it's in this revanchist state that Turkey is somehow reliving the events of the early 20th century. And it's clear that in his rhetoric and his posturing, he sort of set, you know, Erdogan sets himself up kind of akin to Ataturk in 1919, or at least like a mythologized Ataturk of 1919. You know, this leader who single-handedly will save the state and nation at the hands of enemies, foreign and domestic. And this seems to be a trope that, you know, permeates all levels of analysis in the press and within government circles, that while the names have changed, the forces are the same. You know, there are still these traitors, like in 1919, be they, you know, in 1919, Greeks and Armenians, there are these traitors among us in contemporary Turkish society, in this case being radical Kurds and Gulenists, and that these traitors are being backed by these forces abroad. And again, the states have changed, but the intention is the same, which is to break up the country, to destroy it, whatever sort of nightmare scenario it may be. So the state or Erdogan requires a sort of singular importance and requires this kind of militancy and this sort of attentiveness and unquestioned loyalty in order to prevent this sort of apocalypse that almost happened, you know, that seemingly almost happened in 1919, but is now sort of happening before our very eyes, if you're to believe this, you know, this sort of line of thinking. So, you know, you're correct in sort of insinuating that this is sort of a self-fulfilling turn in how, you know, to think about politics in the country. And it is inherently destabilizing. And again, it's not good.
That was Ryan Gingeras. Thank you very much to him. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the other books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and supporting this podcast at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Also remember to rate or review this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. Email recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And finally, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Vommel, Steve Bryant and Aaron Ataman. But until we meet again in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Tellim anam tellidir, tellidir amma.